Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Sarah Williams reporting. U.S. warplanes attacked an Islamic State training camp in western Libya Friday near the border with Tunisia, hitting their main target and killing dozens of terrorist recruits. Defense officials in Washington said the airstrike likely killed a senior figure in the Islamic State group, Nourdine Chechen, who was linked to two major terrorist incidents in Tunisia last year. The attacks include a museum in Tunis and a beach resort outside the capital, which together killed at least 60 people. The U.S. raid was aimed at a farmhouse on the outskirts of Sabratha, about 75 kilometers west of Tripoli, on Libya's Mediterranean coast. Local reports indicated the airstrike, launched before dawn, killed up to 40 people. American officials who asked not to be identified said most of the casualties were believed to be Islamic State recruits. Provisional results from Uganda's presidential and parliamentary elections show incumbent President Yoweri Museveni in the lead. Early results show President Museveni, who has held power for the past three decades, was reported as holding more than 60% of the votes counted. The vote has been marred by allegations of voter fraud. British Prime Minister David Cameron met European Union officials Friday on the second day of a summit following all-night discussions about Britain's future in the 28-nation grouping. European leaders are discussing the future of Britain's EU membership and the migrant crisis, among other issues, during a two-day summit in Brussels. European Parliament President Martin Schulz told reporters that he believed the summit would end Friday as scheduled. This is VOA News. Bombings in Turkey this week are escalating the conflict between the Turkish government and Kurdish separatists. It's also raising new questions on whom the United States is supporting in the Syrian conflict and the scope of U.S. objectives. Analysts warn the attacks could also lead to a wider involvement by Turkish forces in Syria and further strain relations with the U.S. The United Nations warned conflict-ridden Yemen is on the brink of a humanitarian catastrophe. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The United Nations reports more than 6,000 civilians have been killed and well over 3,000 wounded since the Saudi-led coalition began its bombing campaign against the Houthi rebels at the end of March. The UN says more than 2.5 million people have been forced to flee their homes and are internally displaced because of the conflict, and that 21 million need humanitarian support. Despite the situation, the UN Humanitarian Coordinator for Yemen, Jamie McGoldrick, says Yemen has become a forgotten crisis.
I don't think it's helpful to compare crisis for crisis, but I would say that Yemen is as difficult and as dangerous, maybe not in terms of scale, but in terms of intensity.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The casket carrying the body of Justice Antonin Scalia arrived at the Supreme Court Friday, nearly a week after he died at a remote hunting resort in Texas. Former clerks who served for the deceased justice stood on the steps of the court as the hearse bearing the casket arrived. Scalia's casket was carried up the grand staircase by Supreme Court police officers and placed on a historic raised bier built in 1865 to support the body of assassinated President Abraham Lincoln. Voters in two diverse U.S. states are expected to further clarify the races in the Democratic and Republican field Saturday as the quest for the White House intensifies. South Carolina is having a Republican primary, while Nevada holds a Democratic caucus. Ahead of the South Carolina primary, comments by Republican Party frontrunner Donald Trump and Pope Francis about building a border wall between Mexico and the United States have ignited controversy. An Alabama website reports that Harper Lee, author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book To Kill a Mockingbird, died Friday at age 89 in Monroeville, Alabama. Lee was born in Monroeville and lived for many years in New York City. But after suffering a stroke in 2007, she moved back to her hometown. She had been a resident in an assisted living facility. Services for Lee have not been announced. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Iris Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
I have a passion for my country, and I believe I have a say in shaping the future of Uganda. And I believe that my vote is very important and has the power to do so. So I had to come. Actually, I was so disappointed yesterday when I didn't cast my vote. I thought all hope was gone until it was announced there is another chance of voting, so I could not miss this one.
That's a Ugandan voter taking advantage of an extension to cast her ballot for presidential and legislative elections. Details coming up.
Also, as countries and health officials move quickly to stem the spread of the Zika virus, many approaches are being considered to target the mosquito that carries it.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Ghana, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, tensions escalated in Uganda today following the third arrest this week of opposition presidential candidate Kizza Besigye. Protesters threw stones and blocked roads in the capital, Kampala, and police fired tear gas to bring the situation under control. Meanwhile, partial election results show Besigye trailing President Yoweri Museveni. Elizabeth Pula has the full story from Kampala.
The situation was tense Friday following clashes outside the headquarters of the Forum for Democratic Change, the political party of opposition candidate Kizza Besigye. The altercation started after Besigye called a press conference Friday afternoon. Police surrounded the building and fired tear gas into the FDC compound. Soon after, they arrested Besigye and several top-level FDC members. Besigye's wife has tweeted that he was taken to Nagalama police station outside the city. This led FDC supporters to throw stones at police and set up barricades near the FDC headquarters, Kaseka Market, Katwe, and Bwezi. Much of the unrest was put down quickly by the Ugandan police using tear gas. Residents also report hearing gunfire, although there has been no confirmation as to whether these were rubber bullets or live ammunition. The Ugandan Red Cross says four injured persons were taken to Malago Hospital, although none had bullet wounds. Police have now been heavily deployed throughout Kampala. Police spokesperson Fred Inanga put out a statement saying they had received intelligence students were planning a riot and that the heavy deployment of military police was a preventative measure. The U.S. Embassy has warned Americans in Kampala to stay off the streets. Meanwhile, in Kololo, police surrounded the residence of another presidential candidate, Amama Mbabazi. Mbabazi was later escorted off the premises by a police officer, although it was not clear if this was an arrest. Tensions have been high in Uganda since Thursday, when many polling stations did not receive voting materials until late in the day. This led to confrontations between voters and the police, which included multiple rounds of tear gas. Although polling stations opened again in some areas Friday, many feel the delays were part of an effort by the Ugandan Electoral Commission to rig the election, an allegation denied by the commission. Besigye was initially arrested at a rally on Monday and again on Thursday night when he arrived at a house in the suburb of Naguru and accused those inside of stuffing ballot boxes. Partial results show incumbent President Yoweri Museveni leading with around 62% of the vote, with Besigye running a distant second. The winner of the presidential elections is expected to be announced Saturday afternoon. Elizabeth Pola for VOA News, Kampala.
The international aid group Doctors Without Borders says at least 18 people were killed in armed conflict at a UN protection of civilians site this week, including two South Sudanese staff members attacked in their own homes. The report regarding the site in Malakal increases the previously reported death toll of 7, which was reported yesterday. MSF said the two staff members killed were workers at one of its hospitals inside the compound. MSF spokesman Marcus Backman reported that medical teams worked throughout the night to treat some 73 people wounded in the attack, the majority of whom had gunshot wounds. More injured people were arriving at the hospital today.
The conflict took place between youths from two different ethnic communities, Dinka and Shilluk. UN Mission in South Sudan, UNMISS, spokesperson Ariane Quintieri said fighting erupted Wednesday night, with the young people using machetes, guns, and other weapons against each other. The attack forced some 600 people to gather inside the hospital for shelter. UNMISS spokeswoman Quintieri said UN military personnel used tear gas to disperse the combatants. UNMISS said the attackers were targeting people who are under the protection of the United Nations, a clear violation of international law. South Sudan's information minister told VOA that UN forces are responsible for the defense of the compound and not the government.
As weather begins to warm across the Aegean Sea, experts predict higher flows of migrants and refugees trying to enter Europe. More than 1 million migrants entered in the last 14 months. Those who fail the test of refugee status are being deported from Germany, the preferred destination of most migrants and refugees, and from Greece, the most popular country for entry. Judith Kumin spent 32 years with the UN Refugee Agency and was the director of their bureau. Kumin spoke with VOA's David Arnold in Washington, D.C. about the lengthy and contentious deportation process now in place.
It's important to say that deportation is not easy because the country of origin frequently doesn't cooperate with the return of the individuals. The nationality of the individuals is not always clear. People don't always have papers. And then, of course, there are issues of cost, of reluctance to use force to remove people, and ongoing legal barriers, because in states of law, people do appeal to the courts, and the courts quite often take a long time to render their decisions. The cornerstone of international refugee law is the principle of non-refoulement, and that means that no state will forcibly return a person to a situation where he or she would face persecution or serious harm. The other side of this coin is the fact that states do not have an obligation under international law to allow people to remain if they don't face serious risks at home. These people who are not refugees can be deported if they don't agree to leave voluntarily. But of course, the key to this is that there must have been a full and fair assessment of whether they qualify for refugee status or not.
In terms of African countries, where are they being sent?
Well, those are, for the most part, returns to country of origin, and those are reliant for the most part on bilateral agreements between the sending country and the country of origin, because the European Union hasn't concluded readmission agreements yet with African countries. But Nigeria is a key one, Ghana also, because there are quite a few instances of people who initially claim to come from Liberia or Sierra Leone who actually turn out to be Ghanaians. And the European Union is very interested in being able to accelerate returns to North African countries, and in particular to Morocco and Algeria, because the numbers of asylum seekers arriving from those countries appears to be on the rise.
Germany has been the most welcoming of all countries and taken in the largest number of migrants and refugees. How are they handling the deportation process?
Well, Germany is doing what it has always done, which is to implement a very thorough individual status determination procedure with a full appeal allowed, and then to expect people who've been found not to be in need of protection to leave. But like other countries, the German authorities have found that getting people actually to leave is harder than it sounds. Even though last year around 21,000 people left Germany, that's objectively a large number. It's a very small number compared to the something like 1 million people who entered the country. And they don't leave because their nationality isn't always clear, because they don't have papers, because people don't cooperate, they protest, they abscond, they disappear, because countries of origin don't cooperate, and because there's understandably a real reluctance on the part of civil society to see force used to remove people from the country. And for all of these reasons, there has been a relatively low number of people actually leaving after they've been found not to be in need of protection.
It sounds like a very complex problem.
I think it would be important to say that this is part of a whole constellation of issues involving conditions in countries of origin, restoring borders, removing people not in need of protection, cooperation among countries, whether within the European Union or outside the European Union, massive effort to help people to integrate. And it's very difficult to achieve international cooperation on these issues. What we see is a kind of regression into the national interest rather than looking at the interests of the international community as a whole. And unfortunately, when this happens, it's very often the genuine refugee who is the victim.
That was Judith Comeen talking to VOA's David Arnold about the deportations from Europe.
As countries and health officials move quickly to stem the spread of the Zika virus, many approaches are being considered to target the mosquito that carries it. The Aedes aegypti mosquito also transmits dengue fever. One of the novel methods being studied is the use of the Wolbachia bacteria. When mosquitoes are artificially infected with Wolbachia, the bacteria block them from becoming infected with RNA viruses that include Zika, dengue, and chikungunya. Among those studying Wolbachia is Jason Rosgon, Associate Professor of Entomology and Disease Epidemiology at Penn State University. He spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua about the bacteria.
So Wolbachia lives inside the cells of other organisms. It's estimated to occur in somewhere between 40 and 70% of all insects. So it's probably the most widespread symbiotic bacterium on the planet. And it's in lots of different insects, but it's not in some species of mosquitoes that are important because they transmit pathogens to humans. But researchers found that when you actually take Wolbachia out of an infected insect, so this could be out of a fruit fly, for instance, and artificially infect mosquitoes that don't normally carry it, those mosquitoes often become highly resistant to transmission of pathogens. You could artificially infect, let's say, Aedes aegypti mosquitoes that don't normally carry it, and that would make them to be unable to transmit certain viruses. And then you could release those mosquitoes, and they would breed with the natural population. And over a fairly short period of time, the Wolbachia infection would spread through the population, turning it into a population of mosquitoes that can no longer maintain pathogen transmission.
And this bacteria is not harmful to people?
It does not infect people. It only infects invertebrates, so it's been found in insects, spiders, some crustaceans, and it's in some nematodes.
So tell me about your research into the bacteria.
I've been working on Wolbachia for quite a long time. I did my PhD on Wolbachia, and we have been looking at it for a long time, trying to put it into anopheline mosquitoes for malaria control. But while we were doing this work, we also had a large project on Culex mosquitoes and West Nile virus. And so when the research was going on by other groups with Wolbachia and Aedes aegypti and dengue virus, we thought, hey, this would be a really good system to adapt to the Culex West Nile system, and then maybe we can have a potential control strategy for West Nile. And what we found is that under certain conditions, when you artificially infect some mosquitoes, such as the Culex species we work with, which is Culex tarsalis, with Wolbachia, it doesn't always block pathogen transmission. It can sometimes actually enhance pathogen transmission. And we've also seen this with some rodent malaria species, although the human malaria parasite was always suppressed. So it just says that this sort of idea that Wolbachia can always suppress pathogens is not always true. Sometimes you can get the opposite of what you were expecting.
So in your view, considering your research, is it something that should be tried regarding Zika?
So I was a little concerned about it. However, the experiment, to my knowledge, of whether the Wolbachia strain that's already being released in Brazil has already been tested against Zika virus, and it does block. The data is not published yet, but I believe it's going to be soon. This is what the researchers have told me.
In layman's terms, would you explain how you actually infect these mosquitoes with Wolbachia and then release them?
You actually either purify the Wolbachia, usually from the eggs of an infected host, or sometimes you grow it actually in cultured insect cells in a dish in the laboratory. You purify the Wolbachia out of those cells, and then with a very, very fine glass micro needle, you inject it into the eggs of the insect that's not infected. And then if you're lucky, that infection will take and become stable, and then it will be transmitted maternally from that insect to its offspring, and you can establish a line of mosquitoes that's stably infected with the Wolbachia, and then you can take those mosquitoes and then rear them up and release them into the environment.
What's the advantage of doing this as opposed to using insecticides?
If it works, the advantage is it's self-sustaining. So insecticides, you kind of have to keep doing it.
So you've studied this for many years. What more do you need to know?
There's a lot we need to know. In general, the actual mechanism of how Wolbachia blocks pathogens in mosquitoes is still not completely understood. We don't know how they're going to interact differently with different mosquitoes. We don't know how transferable this technology is across different mosquito species.
Have you heard all the media reports regarding the vector control or mosquito control regarding Zika? And if so, what's your reaction?
I've seen a lot of sort of conspiracy theories and things in the media about how either Wolbachia infection or genetically modified mosquitoes or even pesticide use is responsible for the big Zika outbreaks and the microcephaly and the other things that we're seeing. And I would say that there's absolutely no evidence for any of those things, and people shouldn't panic and kind of glom on to these kind of anti-technology conspiracy theories to try to explain what's going on.
Jason Razgun is Associate Professor of Entomology and Disease Epidemiology at Penn State University. He spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua.
And in U.S. politics, the two candidates for the Democratic Party are vying for the African-American vote. Senator Bernie Sanders and former U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton recently made campaign stops in New York's traditionally African-American neighborhood, Harlem. Both are busy courting African-American voters in upcoming state contests, including in Nevada on Saturday and South Carolina a week later. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke to potential voters in Harlem and has this report.
Despite torrential rains, an overflow crowd filled the lobby of Harlem's Schoenberg Center for Research in Black Culture on Tuesday. The people came to hear Hillary Clinton make a speech about race, mass incarceration, and economic equality. One attendee, named Takesha, who preferred to give only her first name, told the VOA she remains undecided but not neutral about the candidate.
I like her. I think she's smart. I think she represents a lot of the issues that, you know, black families want in a candidate, but I'm interested to hear how specifically what sorts of positions she's going to share with us this afternoon.
What kind of issues do you think are important?
Economic equality, education, housing, health, human services, you name it, it runs the gamut.
Any thoughts about what Sanders says?
You know, I have to give him a closer look. I haven't really listened to him much, but I mean, he certainly makes practical sense. I'm just curious about what a Sanders president would look like.
Herb Boyd is a longtime Harlem political activist who worked on both Jesse Jackson's presidential campaign in 1988 and the Reverend Al Sharpton's 2004 campaign. He says Clinton and Sanders' policies are more alike than different.
I like both of them, and they're pretty much on the same page in many respects. Obviously, you're talking about the idealist versus the pragmatist. I tend to fall on the side of being the pragmatist. I've been to the idealist route before and had my heart broken at least four or five times now. And while Bernie's feeling the burn here in Harlem is not radiating like it is for Hillary, and that's to be understandable, you know, given her history and connection to this community. Bill Clinton having his office right here in Harlem, it gives him like a leg up.
If so, the Clintons will get no boost from Mike Kroski, another Harlemite.
It's like a dynasty, a royalty, you know. We need a change. We need a change. Her husband hasn't done anything for Harlem. He gentrified Harlem. He moved all the poor people out. I think Sanders is our man, but I really don't think the country is ready for him. They try to label him as socialist, but he's a Democrat at heart.
Julius Hollingsworth vastly prefers both Sanders and Clinton to anyone in the Republican race. Still,
they both have their good points and wishy-washy points.
Yeah. What's the wishy-washy point you'd like to see clarified?
Well, I'd like to understand more clearly where Mr. Sanders, what his foreign policy would be, really. And I would really like to understand clearly where Hillary stands in terms of banks and influence and those kind of things. I guess that's the major part. They're at least in the realm of reality for me. The opposition isn't even in the ballpark of reality.
A Sanders supporter named Tony says it's Sanders' character that attracts him.
He's a pretty faithful and, I think, honest public servant. And I think when you look at issues like mass incarceration, you know, thinking about the Iraq War, Hillary Clinton, she changes her position with the win. And so I think it's time for the American people to reward someone who's consistently honest.
Stefan Boatwright likes Sanders' economic policies.
What he's talking about with tackling poverty that disproportionately helps black people because we're disproportionately poor, and just having those types of aggressive working class issues, I think he's going to win over a lot of black support.
Eric Apple remains undecided between the two Democratic candidates, even though he's been inspired by the youthful passion driving the Sanders campaign.
It's got young folks fired up, and I think that's an excellent strategy, an excellent way to get, you know, people motivated. You go for the young people. I don't think that they're that far apart, so I feel that I'm somewhere in between.
Are you leaning a little bit toward one or the other?
I'm leaning towards Hillary. You know, I know that she has the experience and she can come in day one and get things done.
Hillary supporter Bertha Lewis is angry. She says this election is not really about economic policy or race or age. For her, it's about whether or not Americans will finally elect a female president and commander-in-chief.
And I'm just really pissed off that people don't understand and recognize that. Mm-hmm. When are we finally going to shatter this glass ceiling? Mm-hmm. When are we going to get with the rest of the planet? Mm-hmm. We, you know, other nations have had women leaders. And it's like, what's a girl got to do? No matter how accomplished you are, there is a fear of women. There's always been a fear of women, even Democrats. It's disgusting.
Whether the many upcoming state nominating contests will hand Sanders or Clinton the number of delegates they need to lead the Democratic ticket in November, supporters from both camps do agree on one thing. If disappointed supporters on the losing side stay away from the polls in November and do not vote, it could easily hand the presidency to the Republicans. That is an outcome the grand old party would certainly welcome. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
Contests to determine the candidates for the Republican Party nomination takes place this week in South Carolina on Saturday and in Nevada a week later.
In more news on the continent, suicide bombers disguised as food vendors killed more than 20 residents of Meme, a village in northern Cameroon today. The governor of far northern Cameroon says 70 more residents were wounded and have been taken to a hospital in Tocomemberi. A teacher in a nearby town said two more suicide bombers were walking toward a school when they were discovered. They died when they detonated their explosives in the bush 1 mile from the school.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
On Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best Pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This one, this one,
every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists, too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best right here on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Uganda's National Elections Commission announces this morning the incumbent Yoweri Museveni has the lead with 37% of all votes counted. And the international aid group Doctors Without Borders says at least 18 people were killed in armed conflict at a UN protection site in South Sudan. Coming up, we'll have music from Ghana. And in our feature segment, a Cameroonian artist motivates women all over the world. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And, of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Friday, Sunny.
Happy Friday, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you are talking about Olympic news that's topping your sports today.
Kim, this is a big Olympic year as athletes around the world look forward to August when the Rio Games will be held in Brazil. Ahead of Rio 2016, a new movie chronicles one of the greatest Olympians in history, American sprinter Jesse Owens, who won four gold medals at the 1936 Olympics in Berlin, Germany. Jesse's triumphant performance put a big dent in Adolf Hitler's notion of Nazi superiority. But after Berlin, Jesse Owens came home to an America still deeply divided between black and white. The new film is titled Race, and it's directed by Stephen Hopkins. The movie chronicles the Berlin Olympics 80 years ago, using the Great Depression as the backdrop to Owens's coming-of-age story as a star athlete who's living with racism at home here in the USA. VOA's Penelope Pulu tells us more about the new Jesse Owens movie, Race.
The youngest of 10 children, Jesse Owens, realized that running fast and winning could be more important than skin color.
Things are going to turn around. You'll see.
Leaving his family behind with a promise for a better life, he enrolls at Ohio State as a track athlete.
Have a problem, Coach?
No.
You want me to do it again?
Yeah.
Coach Larry Snyder recognizes Owens' potential.
You want to win a gold medal?
Sure.
You want to do it in Berlin?
I heard they don't care much for color folk over there.
Well, they don't care for him much here in Columbus either.
The film follows Owens' training and shattering of world records while the U.S. Olympic Committee wrangles over whether to participate in Hitler's Olympics, and members of the African-American community ask Owens to boycott the event.
Mr. Owens,
how can you justify taking part in Germany when there's so much discrimination here at home?
Despite the mounting pressures, Owens decides to participate. His four Olympic gold medals show Hitler's boast about white Aryan superiority for a lie that it is. His victories pave the way for other black athletes.
Owens!
However, he returns to a segregated America as just another black man rather than an Olympic hero. Stefan James, who portrays Owens, says the film celebrates the athlete and what he achieved in spite of the odds.
A film like Race, really shows why it doesn't matter what you look like or where you come from. All that really matters is individual greatness.
The actor acknowledges that America has come a long way since 1936, but says there is still a lot more to be done.
I really feel like this film shows why, not only how far we've come, since those times, but why we can't afford to go backwards.
Congressman John Lewis agrees. At the movie premiere, he addressed the controversy about the lack of diversity in Hollywood.
And the entertainment industry will wake up and start including all of us. Because it doesn't make any difference whether we are African-American, whether we are white, Latino, Asian American, or Native American.
For those 10 seconds, you are completely
run from there.
free.
On the track, Jesse Owens symbolized that unity. Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
And a few Jesse Owens tidbits. He died in 1980 at the age of 66. The cause was lung cancer. Ironically, while Jesse was the epitome of health after his spectacular performance in Berlin 80 years ago, he was also a pack-a-day cigarette smoker for 35 years. In 1981, a year after his death, USA Track and Field created the Jesse Owens Award, given annually to the country's top track and field athlete. And this personal Jesse Owens anecdote: when I was a little boy, I had an up-close and personal moment with Jesse Owens at a stoplight in Norfolk, Virginia. Jesse was on a promotional tour, and he pulled up next to my family's car in a convertible with festive bunting on the side of the vehicle that proclaimed, "Jesse Owens, Olympic champion." I stuck my head out the window and yelled, "Go, Jesse!" Trust me, VOA sports fans, Jesse heard me, and he responded with a smile and a wave.
Friends, we can all listen to the sunny side of sports.
Yes, my friend.
The sunny side of sports.
Sunny side of sports.
The sunny side of sports show.
Great show, bro. This is sunny side of sports.
Sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
Voice of America.
Stand up. Stand up. Stand up. Stand up.
Let's stand up now for Andrew Palcheski, VOA's social media reporter. Sporty greetings, Andrew.
Sporty greetings, Sonny.
Andrew, what's trending in the sports world on this Friday?
Well, we talked about on Wednesday Manny Pacquiao and how he had come out on social media and said some things about gay people saying they were worse than animals. And at the end of our segment on Wednesday, we said, well, this could have a financial impact on him. Mm. And sure enough, the next day, Nike has come out and said, we're cutting our sponsorship, we're pulling our funding from Manny Pacquiao. So it's certainly his social media actions have had a big financial effect on him.
You could say Nike hit him where it hurts.
Absolutely. It always comes back to the dollars and cents. But interestingly, after Nike made this decision, Manny Pacquiao went back to Instagram, put up another post where he said, you know, gay people are terrible, those kind of things, using biblical verses. So I think that after Nike pulled their funding, he said, well, I have nothing to lose now because they've taken the money that they were going to pay me, so I may as well let my views be known.
Do you see other possible commercial sponsors withdrawing their financial support to Pacquiao?
I think so. I think it's when you see a lot of times, especially with social media controversies like this, when someone says something on social media, even if they apologize, even if they delete the tweet or whatever they posted, it's kind of a snowball effect. It starts, you know, slowly. This is an interesting case because Nike is a big marquee sponsor. So it may have actually kind of the same result, but in an opposite way. Rather than slowly kind of building until the big sponsors pull their money, you may have this big sponsor pull its money and then other smaller ones say, okay, well, if Nike's out, then we're going to be out too.
Andrew, I mentioned on Wednesday how Pacquiao is training for a fight in April, what he says will be his last fight against American Timothy Bradley. In some strange way, could this controversy maybe spur ticket sales for that fight?
Absolutely. It could spur ticket sales, and it could spur a lot of dislike for Manny Pacquiao. I don't think he's going to have many fans in that arena when he's boxing in April. But it'll be interesting to see if this kind of percolates and continues to grow. Based on what Manny Pacquiao's done and continuing to post, I think it's something that's going to linger for a long time and quite possibly through that fight in April.
In terms of social media, I encourage our Voice of America listeners to follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny, and my Twitter handle is @VOA Sunny Sports. And check out the Sunny Side of Sports blog, in which I write about a variety of sporty topics. The address is blogs.voa.com/Sunny. I have a guest blogger this week, VOA intern Rick Narcisse. Rick writes about Emmanuel Mudiay. He is a 19-year-old point guard for the Denver Nuggets in the National Basketball Association. Emmanuel is from the Democratic Republic of Congo. So check out a guest blog this week by Rick Narcisse on Emmanuel Mudiay, who is one of the young stars in the NBA. Andrew, any NBA news that's trending?
You know, we talk a lot about NBA on the show, and this finally is evidence why. The NBA has announced that it is the first sports league in the world to surpass 1 billion social media followers.
Wow.
And they're counting Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and a couple of social media networks in China as part of this. Now, that includes all the NBA teams, all the NBA players who are on social media, owners. So it's a pretty big pool that they're pulling together to get to that 1 billion. And, of course, the NBA is a fairly big league. It has a little over 24 teams, I'd say about 30 teams or so, roughly. So there's a lot of different team accounts that it's pulling together as well, but a huge milestone for them. And certainly something that's around the world, a huge topic of conversation on social media between players like LeBron James and Kobe Bryant to, as we saw this past week, the NBA All-Star Game.
Now, some players tend to tweet a little more than others. Are they encouraged by team management to promote themselves and the team?
I think it depends on the team, but I think as social media is growing more and more, you're seeing a lot of teams stepping in, and if not telling players what to say or directing them, at least giving them some parameters. There was actually a very interesting article I read from Social Times talking about how athletes can use social media to their advantage. And one of the things they suggest is taking it off of the field or off of the court, show some of your personal interest and hobbies, really build a connection with your fans. So I think that doing that helps these athletes grow their social media audiences. I think focusing on their personal lives also, rather than controversial topics, helps them. It keeps the teams from having to regulate what they say. And as we see in Manny Pacquiao's case, it keeps them out of trouble.
I remember at the recent NBA All-Star Game, Kobe pointed out how his daughters attended the game, and he was basically conversing with them during the game. Kind of that personal touch you're talking about.
Exactly. And I think back to the NBA Finals last year with Steph Curry and his daughter. She became kind of a social media celebrity because she kind of took the mic at the press conference, his little 2 or 3 year old daughter, and was singing and twirling around. But it helped him connect with his fans. I mean, people watch him play and they see his stellar performance on the court, but they think, who is this person that I'm a fan of? And so this really helps to connect with that through social media. It gives them an inside look.
Finally, Andrew, bringing it full circle, we heard that report on the Olympics and Jesse Owens. Do you see the Olympians this year stepping up their social media presence?
Oh, absolutely. And it's interesting, too. I follow NBC Sports on Instagram. That's the network here in the U.S. that airs the Olympics. And they're slowly now starting to ramp up, posting more pictures, more photos, counting down the days. So it's definitely over the next few months, right up to Rio, we're going to see a buildup in social media, and it's going to peak for that month. And then after the fact, too, I think for the rest of the year, we're going to see, you know, do you remember this moment? Do you remember this medal ceremony, this athletic competition? So it's going to be really the topic, I think, for the rest of the year.
Andrew Palcheski, VOA social media reporter. Thanks for joining us again, Andrew.
Thanks very much.
See you on Monday.
See you Monday.
I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, a Cameroonian artist motivating women around the world. And next, a nonprofit organization in Africa helping students to read. But first, some music. Here is Rocky Duane of Ghana with Walls Come Tumbling Down.
To walk just to make it to their door, only to be told we were too late. How many picket lines we cross just to get back off the floor, then we fall back in the same old game. But it made me realize to see the line and train, the shadows of the hand that always pulled the strings
for those who understand. The beginning, see the end. Guess who is rising again? Me again, knocking on your door till all your walls come tumbling down. Me again, like Jericho before. Babylon walls come tumbling down, 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 down. Walls tumbling down. Election promises have failed. Those who spoke up have been jailed. Yet we go about pretend we don't see. As I walk through shanty towns, got us choked with broken dreams. Yeah, they trickle down, don't come so far. But it made me recognize they go to every lane, bend every wheel till they can get all the way. But this time around, they cannot push us around. Guess who is rising again? Knocking on your door till all your walls come tumbling down. Me again, like Jericho before. Babylon walls come tumbling down, 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 down. Walls tumbling down. Some people say that I am weak, cause I turn the other cheek, only to be disappointed again. What kind of future awaits the weak in a world so full with greed? Those with most are those who have to gain. But it made me understand, to see the line and trend of the shadows of the hand that always pulls the string. For those who understand the beginning or the end, Rastaman will rise again. Me again, knocking on your door till all your walls come tumbling down. Me again, like Jericho before. Babylon walls come tumbling down. Me again, on the door, all your walls come tumbling down. It's me again,
going down.
Ghana's Roky Duani with Walls Come Tumbling Down.
Cameroonian artist Josephine Atanga devotes herself to motivating women all over the world. Atanga spoke with VOA's Esther Gitui Ewart about her nonprofit organization, WODES, and the name stands for Women Designed for Success. Atanga's mission to empower one woman at a time.
Josephine Atanga is a multi-talented woman. She's a motivational speaker, a talk show host, and a music artist. She says WODES stands for Women Designed for Success and wants every woman to identify her talent.
I came up with this organization in order to empower women, and especially women in Africa. I realize that women are doing so much in Africa, and we are here in the diaspora. What can we as women in the diaspora do to empower these women that are back in Africa?
She says her organization's goal is to help women identify their purpose.
We believe that every woman was created with a purpose to be successful. So many women, especially in Africa, you don't find that purpose. So we believe that in collaboration, you know, coming together as one, because there's power in unity, we'll be able to help you find your purpose and support you.
And my question to you is...
But how does one find that purpose? What are the pointers to one's hidden talent?
First thing is for you to love yourself. When you love yourself, you'll be able to figure out who is Josephine. And when you love yourself, you'll be able to appreciate who you are and find value.
She says people waste their talents when they fail to be reflective and pursue what they are good at. But how does she define success?
Success does not necessarily mean money. I could be called to be a cleaner, just to mop the floor, and I do it so well. In that area, I am considered a successful person.
Woodes is helping women in her native country of Cameroon and other parts of the continent. She discovered women talented in embroidery. Through a Maryland fashion show in the U.S., she gave the women exposure. The effort is paying off. Models wore their embroidered clothes on the runway.
So I have been able to bring them to the limelight so the world can see exactly this beautiful fabric from Cameroon. And for the first time, put them on Maryland Fashion Week. It was a blast.
Her foundation is also helping women in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
We also started a branch in Congo, and the whole idea is to give out microloans to women. They have to undergo training. And when they undergo training to how to run a business, after 1 year, we expect you to take that money and invest in the life of another woman.
This talk show host also started an online show to positively highlight stories about Africa. The show is called Gospel Drum. The one-hour show now airs Sundays in Prince George's County in the state of Maryland, USA. Esther Githu-Ewart, VOA News, Washington.
A nonprofit organization called World Reader is making a difference for girls at a school in Nairobi, Kenya. The publishing group provides tens of thousands of free e-readers to students and teachers in 12 African countries. Each free reader gives the students access to thousands of digital books. VOA's Deborah Block reports on the work of World Reader e-books.
Here at the Kibera Girls Soccer Academy, 17-year-old Naima Hassan and her fellow high school students have been using the World Reader device for a couple of years. Hassan considers herself lucky.
I get to learn everything that I want.
She says the e-reader has helped improve her education at her school in Nairobi because there is a lack of textbooks.
The textbooks that we have cannot be used by everyone in the school. So with the e-readers, now we can learn at a comfortable pace.
The San Francisco-based World Reader Organization says its e-reader can increase reading comprehension in the African schools where it's being used. With so much information on the device, including books from African authors, Hassan's teacher, Clarissa Kinyi, says the students can learn more than they ever could before.
The girls are able to do research, so it is more accessible for them. They don't need to find from the dictionary probably the meaning of some words from the subjects that I'm teaching.
Hassan says the World Reader motivates her to learn about a lot of things. Besides English, there are books in many languages, including Swahili, Kenya's national language. Her teacher uses it to plan her classes.
So when I need to prepare a lesson using different books, I can easily access the materials. Then the World Reader is also easily portable. I can carry it home so as to prepare a lesson for different classes.
Hassan likes the portability too, and shares the e-reader with her family.
My mom reads like those Swahili textbooks, and my brother likes playing game on the e-reader.
Akinyi also likes reading for pleasure.
While at home, at times, I read some of the books for fun. For instance, we have a book titled Obama in that particular e-reader. So mostly I do read that particular book.
For Hassan, the World Reader is helping her towards her dream of becoming a TV camera woman.
Using the e-reader, you can download a book about a camera. Then you can learn everything about a camera.
Akinyi says, thanks to World Reader, disadvantaged students like Hassan have a better chance of getting into college after high school. Deborah Block, VOA News, Washington.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer Peter Hundley, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
If we are to be successful in our efforts to defeat and eventually eliminate violent terrorist groups, we must adopt a truly global approach in every sense of the word. This means that the community of nations must work together to address every major aspect of this scourge. Take ISIL, for example. Over the past 2 years, this group has managed to attract significant numbers of foreign terrorist fighters and inspired other like-minded violent extremist groups to align themselves with ISIL. It uses social media to spread its message, to radicalize and recruit individuals to violence. Its propaganda has also managed to inspire individuals or small groups to conduct violent attacks in numerous cities around the world. We are addressing this challenge head-on, said U.S. Ambassador at Large and Coordinator for Counterterrorism, Tina Cadenell. But we are not doing so alone. Indeed, the United States is just one part of a coalition of 66 partners. With nearly 10,000 airstrikes, we are methodically taking their leadership off the battlefield, as well as going after their heavy weapons, oil tankers, training camps, bulk cash storage, and their infrastructure. At the same time, in cooperation with local ground forces, we have taken back 20 to 25% of the populated territory ISIL once held in Iraq and Syria. And in Iraq alone, ISIL has lost 40% of what it held at its peak in August 2014. But much that needs to be done has no military solutions, said Ambassador Cadenell. The community of nations must work together to deny terrorists reinforcements of foreign terrorist fighters. We must cut off their access to financing, disrupt and expose their messaging, and stabilize the vulnerable communities that have been liberated from ISIL control. And so an ever-increasing number of nations is closing security loopholes, identifying, arresting, and even prosecuting foreign fighters heading to join ISIL. Countries are sharing information and working together to identify triggers and prevent radicalization, recruitment, and mobilization of individuals into terrorist groups. The terrorism challenges we face continue to evolve at a rapid pace, said Ambassador Cadenell. We need to bring strong, capable, and diverse partners to the forefront and enlist their help in the mutually important endeavor of global counterterrorism.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
With your ears on Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best Pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC. Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best right here on VOA Africa.
Tuesday on Health Chat, host Denor Madou discusses leprosy, a chronic infection. Is it contagious? Is there a cure? For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. For listeners to call during the show, our telephone number is 202-619-3111. Health Chat this Tuesday at 1730 UTC, right here on VOA Africa. The Voice.
Voice of America, VOA.